Okay. So you thought last week was strange. Wait, you hear about it, what we're going to do this week. I'm sure that people will keep coming in, but we generally, if you don't know, we generally start off with a meditation, and I have been week by week introducing more and more aspects of mindfulness. It's only been 2 weeks, so yeah, so I've only introduced more. I introduced it and then introduced one more, so now it's more and more. Okay. For those of you who practice mindfulness, just be patient and mindful here for about 5 minutes while I explain this to everybody else. I just want to make sure everybody's kind of taking the steps one at a time. The first week, I talked about just relaxing and bringing attention to your breathing. So I said that the great trap that people who try to be mindful get into is to try to change what's in their mind somehow. And that's not what the mindfulness instruction is. The mindfulness instruction is just become aware of what's happening. Don't interact with it. So how you do that is you bring attention to your breathing. Just keep returning attention to your breathing. The problem is we're so accustomed to thinking that when I tell you to turn attention to your breathing, you think about your breathing. That's thinking. Put your hand on your belly and feel it go out and in as your diaphragm rises and falls. And just keep returning attention to your belly rising and falling. Or if you hate your belly, to the air in and out of your nostrils. You can put a finger underneath there and the air will come in and out of your nostrils. You can feel that. The idea is you're paying attention to a physical feeling, not to a thought about a physical feeling. So why do I tell you to return attention to your breathing? Because it turns out that our attention doesn't stay where we put it for more than about a millisecond. Well, 2 or 3 seconds if you're lucky, and then it's off into thought again. We're so accustomed to thinking that steadying attention on anything other than thinking is a difficult proposition for us. So it's not a question of sticking your attention on your breathing because it won't stick. It's a question of every time your attention wanders off like a little puppy, this is Jack Kornfield's metaphor, you bring your attention back, you bring the puppy back, put it back where you want it, it wanders off. You know. And how often do you do that for the rest of your life? It never learns, really, but it learns a little bit. So the idea is just keep returning attention to your breathing and let everything else be just as it is. That was the first week's instruction. Second week's instruction was, as you're returning attention to your breathing, soften and open. Let everything that you're aware of that is contracted or dense or narrowed open. So you let your head open so your thoughts can flow. You let your face open so the expression that you're crunched up on, you know, that lets go. You let your heart open so your feelings can flow. You let your shoulders open and your body open. And at every level, when you find contraction or narrowing, you just allow it to open. You can't make it open. You just soften and open. You just invite release. So you're breathing. You're getting lost in thought. You're coming back to breathing. And you're remembering to keep softening and opening. And what I said last week is the entire journey from psychological ill health to spiritual enlightenment is a journey of progressive opening. And so if you remember nothing else, just keep opening. Keep allowing things to be as they are and to do what they do. And don't get sucked into any of it. It's all transient. It's all superficial levels of who you really are. So that's what I said last week. So at this point, you're having a really good time. You're just kind of like letting go, and it's really nice, and you're just breathing, and you're letting go and softening, and you're like half asleep, and it's all kind of foggy and beautiful in there, you know, or at least quiet in there. So now I have to crack the whip. Well, that's maybe not the best way to say it. Now I have to give you the opposite instruction. Because when people are trying too hard, the teacher says, relax, don't try so hard. And then when people get the hang of, just relax, and the teacher says, hey, what are you doing? This isn't nap time. Pay attention. So this is the pay attention lesson. The pay attention lesson is, not only do you pay attention to your breath, but you pay attention to the things that enter your awareness. You're the open sky, peaceful, calm, relaxed, open, and aware of thoughts, feelings, and sensations as they happen. There's a thought. There's a sound. There's a feeling. So how do you do this? Let me teach you the technique of labeling. Those of you who have done this a million times, again, I'm trying to abrogate my comments. That is, make them succinct. So how do you do labeling? Labeling is something that not everybody likes to do. Some people do it continuously when they sit. I like to do it for a minute or two. What it does is it takes a lens that's unfocused, the lens of your attention, and it focuses it. So after a minute or two of labeling, I'm really aware of what's going on. Before I label, I'm kind of like, what's going on? So here's labeling. I'm going to demonstrate it by saying out loud what I say internally. And what I'm doing is calling out to myself the most predominant thing I'm aware of. You couldn't label everything because there's so your attention goes so quickly from thing to thing. In fact, the sophisticated instruction here is, can you be aware of two things at once, or is it always sequential? If you're really good at meditation, mindfulness meditation anyway, that's the question you ask yourself. Can I simultaneously be aware of my breath and a thought, or is there a quick alternation between breath and thought? So I'm not calling out everything, and I'm not calling out very often that I'm labeling, because otherwise I'd be going labeling, because you know that's what I'm doing. And I'm not calling out my breathing very much, but I'm aware of my breathing either continuously or I come back to my breathing very frequently. Just give you a demonstration. Hands, shoulders, mouth, eyes, seat, breathing, fingers, hearing, emotion, thinking, breathing, emotion, fingers, thinking, seat, feet, hearing, feeling, thinking, hands. See what I did? As my attention went from thing to thing, I just said to myself what it was. And after I do that for a minute or so, then I don't have to do it anymore. Then I'm clear that thoughts are the words or pictures in my head. Feelings are what's going on in here. Sensations are either within my body or coming through my sense organs.
What's feeling versus emotion?
Oh, feeling and emotion are the same to me. In the books it says that emotions are kind of longer term, multifaceted things of which feelings are part. I think it's nonsense. Feeling is feeling. It's all the state of what emotions are. It's just the state of your body. If you pay attention to the state of your body, you have an emotion. Anyway, that's a whole other lecture. So let's sit for 10 minutes, and in this 10 minutes, you have three charges. Charge one, return attention to your breathing. Every time it leaves your breathing, return attention to your breathing. Gently. Second, soften and open on every level. Third, if you like, after a couple of minutes of not labeling, a couple of minutes of just coming back to your breathing and softening and opening, then for a minute or two, label. And then let go of labeling. That's what I would suggest, although you might want to label all the way through. It's up to you. So breathe, soften and open, and be aware of what's happening by labeling it. Thank you. The reason that people do mindfulness is because when your internal weather is not good, mindfulness gives you the opportunity to take a step back and not be caught in the weather. You become the sky in which there is a storm rather than being the storm. Also, when you realize you're not your thoughts, your feelings, and your sensations, the question comes up, well, then who are you? Because you always thought you were your personality and your body. Now it's clear that you're not, so you begin to pay attention to attention itself. And that's the doorway to spiritual opening. Also, when you were caught up in your life and exhausted as a result, this gives you at least a temporary vacation. And that has hugely salubrious physical effects. That is, it's very healthy to not be so wound up all the time. Nancy?
Do you find that when you're coming to a close on a meditation that your awareness is mostly on your breathing, or are you still aware of all this?
Okay, so the question comes, how much of your awareness is on your breathing versus how much of your awareness is either on whatever, all that's happening, or caught up in thought? If you really need to calm down, just keep coming back to your breathing and don't even pay attention to anything else. That's called a concentration meditation. That will calm you down. Just keep coming back to your breathing. Ignore your thoughts, feelings, and sensations. If you really want to be very present, because you're in a beautiful place or you're doing something that takes a great deal of presence, open your eyes. And then you'll mostly be aware of your sensations. In terms of the course of a meditation, it so much depends on what's going on inside me, you, and everyone else. To what extent we're aware of our breathing, to what extent we're aware of what's going on in our minds and in our bodies, and to what extent we're lost. And you should never be paranoid about having, if you had a 10-minute meditation and you were lost for 9 minutes and 59 seconds. That's called par for the course, okay? You've had a lifetime of being identified with your feelings. It is not going to be a quick fix to suddenly be the sky rather than, you're going to be, the best that can happen is you'll find your breathing sensation in all this stuff. But it's not so simple to witness your thoughts, feelings, and sensations from an uninvolved place. That's a long and worthwhile practice. Just one more thing about that. I always thought I was kind of retarded in this sense because I've been meditating for so many years and I'm still not very enlightened. But I heard Pema Chodron recently say, "Oh yeah, I have meditations where I'm just lost in thought the whole time." The Zen master, you know. All right, so there were a couple questions, then we have to move from this because we got a little adventure. Morty and then Gary.
Thank you. Just say thank you.
Well,
for letting me know that I'm not the only one.
Oh my God, everybody's sitting here thinking, what's wrong with what a dunce I am? I mean, I was lost in thought the whole time. I didn't even remember about the stupid breathing. I asked for labeling, you know what? Look, this is it's amazing that we're so bad at this. I mean, this is a really simple instruction. Just pay attention. You really go lost at things. But we've had a lifetime of one operating system in the computer, and now we're substituting not only a different operating system, but a whole different way of operating the computer. It's not just a little tweak. It's not just mountain lion going to Mavericks. You know, this is a whole different way of looking at yourself and life. And so this is not something that is immediately entirely available to you. And it's worth the practice you put in, because the good news is you do learn to be able to be the sky rather than the storm. You don't walk around the sky. You walk around the storm. You walk around the weather most of the time. But when the weather's lousy, you immediately know to become to get out of absorption in it before you do yourself or somebody else any damage. So this is a long process. It's the opposite of a quick fix, and it's why people are paying serious attention to it, because it's a real rebirth. Gary, and then Abraham, and then we have to move it from this.
So at the beginning of the mindfulness meditation, you're right in your thoughts, feelings, and sensations.
Oh, yeah.
As you progress and you go back to this inner observer, do you have a sense of when you're doing that, when you're getting to be the inner observer and you're no longer involved with your thoughts, feelings, and sensations?
There are a number of guideposts along the way, or encouraging landmarks along the way. The first is when you can actually feel your breathing occasionally. That is, you can actually, it's not just that you're thinking about your breathing, but you feel your belly. You feel your belly, or you feel the air out of your nostrils. And you, at that those moments, you go, "Oh, I'm doing this right. I can feel my breathing." And then you start thinking about how good you are for doing your breathing. So that's the first landmark is encouraging signpost, is that you can feel your breathing occasionally. The second encouraging signpost is a real aha moment. At a certain point, you hear your thoughts, or you see your thoughts, if they're verbal or visual. You know, you hear the words in your head going blah blah blah, and you go, "Oh my God, I'm listening to my own thoughts." And that should be trivial, but it turns out it's not. I mean, I can make you listen to your own, well. All right, you want to listen to your own thoughts? Here we go. A little remediation here. Look down and
say the alphabet to yourself twice in your head and listen to the voice in your head going ABC. That's enough. Once was enough. Twice you would start, twice you would be thinking already. But for that once, you could probably hear a voice in your head going A, B, C, D. And occasionally you have a thought that would take you away from that for a little bit, but you come back to A, B. So that's your thoughts. I just told you what to think and amplified the thought process. That's the words in your head, they're your thoughts. Okay, they're the dominant hemisphere of your brain operating. If there were pictures, it would be the non-dominant hemisphere operating, supposedly. So you have the capacity to witness your own thoughts, to know what you're, to be aware of thinking while it happens. We just don't generally aren't. So when you sit and you breathe and then you can hear your blah, 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 or three levels of blah, 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 blah happening at the same time, then that's a real aha moment because you realize, wait a minute, I'm not my thoughts. I'm the one hearing my thoughts. So those are beginning steps toward, being aware rather than automatically being caught up in thought, feeling, or sensation. There was one more question or comment. Abraham.
Yeah, I know you're trying to make it so exciting, but I feel bored every time I listen to my breathing. Sometimes it feels like after a while it's not funny.
Okay. There are various hurdles here. Some people go to sleep all the time. Different hurdles, okay? Boredom hurdle. When you feel yourself breathe and you get bored, look closely at the boredom. The idea is you don't try to change anything. Nothing is wrong. You pay attention to whatever's coming up. If you look at the boredom closely, it will change into something else. It will become a lot more interesting.
So, next time.
Where is boredom? You know, where is boredom? Where is it? I'm bored. Is that a thought in your head? Is it in your body? Is it in your ear? I mean, whatever comes up as you're learning this process, you pay attention to it and you pay attention to your breathing. We continue. All right. Yes, if you want to. Okay. This is what, fans? Yeah, you like the fans. Okay. All right, so a couple of quick announcements, and then we got to go back into our little adventure story. Okay.
Birth canal.
Really?
Yeah, right. Well, we're in the worst part. We're at least going to get partway out. You know, we're not going to get all the way out today. We're just going to get further. It's going to take another time. I'll try. I'll get us as far as we can go. At least we'll get out of hell, you know. We hope. No, we will. All right, so a couple of things coming up. First, next week, even if we're not completely born yet, Peter Wright, who is a class member, is going to talk to us about past lives and past life regression and past life therapy. This is his life passion. He's currently in San Diego at the National Conference of Past Life Therapists, okay, giving a paper. So he's the best person to talk about this. So he's going to come and talk to us about past life therapy. His name is Peter Wright with a W. And then in 2 weeks, some of you probably read in The Independent Dr. Stephen Hosea, a really famous physician in Santa Barbara, talking about this Qigong master that he studied with who changed his life. That's Master Lee. Some of you are Teacher Lee. Some of you have heard that he's done several things at Pacifica, I guess, in Casa de Maria. And he's really a big deal and the real deal. So next week, the three people in Santa Barbara that he trained to teach his technique are going to come here, in 2 weeks, are going to come here, and they're going to lead us through some Shunzhong Gong, which is Qigong of Universal Love. And Stephen Hosea is going to come. Dr. Hosea is going to come and tell you why it changed his life. And then Nikki Doner Sherwood, who runs the community-centered acupuncture Oriental Medicine Clinic on State Street, is going to come with Pamela Grant, another licensed acupuncturist. And they're the teachers in Santa Barbara. And they're going to take us through several of the Qigong moves in class. So I'm totally happy about that. How that all came together was... okay, William Peters classes. William Peters has come to class, I think, 3 times now. He's giving a free lecture on Wednesday, October 16th at Cottage Hospital, Grand Rounds, I think it is. Yeah, there's a poster for it here. Also, if you're interested in his Life Beyond Death groups, which many people here, several people here anyway, have taken, here's a poster or a flyer for that. Should get on that pretty quick. I think it starts really soon. Mind Supermind. Everything kind of came together this fall. Dr. Jim Kwako is going to talk about heaven as a state of mind potentially available to all of us at any point. So Jim talks a lot about life beyond death. And now he's going to, in particular, he's going to focus on the experience of heaven. That's at Mind Supermind. I think it's $6 because there's a partial scholarship that we got, a partial funding that we got for it. So sign up in advance, please, just so we know how many people to anticipate. It's in the Schott Center Auditorium, so it will be limited. First 150 people get in.
What date is it?
On the 25th of October. That should be a Friday night.
Yes.
Okay. MP3 files. First, if you are looking for the first three classes that of these classes, this is the fourth, I think. The first three are on swt.org/Spencer. You just go there and you can find those three classes and you can download them or listen to them. If you would prefer CDs, MP3 files, you have to listen on an MP3 player or your computer. Here is the opening class, and here is the second class. Anybody want?
Second
goes to you, opening class.
Remind me of your name.
Gloria.
That's right.
Okay.
Life stories.
At 11:30, we'll talk about life stories in art, okay?
Oh, now, no, it's just that they're there tonight.
They are? Oh, that's right, the life story. Yeah, the life stories are... What Robert did is he scanned in all the life stories. So they're actually on swt.org/Spencer. So if you want to be world famous, write a little something, give 2 copies to Donna. Okay, and not only that, but you'll get on the web. Forever. You can't be, it's all archived forever. Tell that to your kids when they, their Facebook pages will follow them around when they're 80. Somebody will say, I saw your Facebook page, man. All right. Here we go. A little disclaimer, I guess. You don't have to take this as true. You can take this as an incredible act of integrative imagination. Okay? This is certainly controversial. However, it makes so much sense and it puts together so much of world culture and individual psychology that many of us have decided to entertain the possibility that what Stan Grof is saying is true. Carl.
Is there any scientific study of the differences in the psychology and the life history of people that are cesarean versus people that are natural born?
Okay, that's a question that I don't know the answer to and should. The way to find that out would be to go to the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology's website. It would probably be under Transpersonal Psychology. I only know of anecdote. I don't know of any systematic study. It's hard to do this kind of stuff. Because life is so ambiguous, it's hard to put it into categories. But you would think that there would be
a lot of the stuff that positive psychology, inventories, and all of
right,
that.
Right. So you,
that's not difficult.
But the question is, who's going to do this? Who's going to do this research? Okay. But yeah, it's always been a question: is to what extent is this going to be empirically verified? All right. Anyway, just 29. I read this and then I interpret it because you have to hear his words. So first, the overall rationale made into just a couple of sentences. Whoa! Before we get there, what we've been looking at is what it's possible to become conscious of, or capital C consciousness, as opposed to small C consciousness, which is what you're aware of now. So what is it possible for you to be aware of? What is what is motivating you in your life, whether you're aware of it or not? What's the non-conscious information processing that's resulting in the you that you're aware of? What's in your unconscious? These are different ways of saying the same thing. So we talked about the personal unconscious. What's happened to you since you were born and how that impacts how you look at the world now. That's well-researched, substantiated stuff. I mean, that's the stuff of clinical psychology, is how has what you've learned and what you've experienced given you a worldview, given you a way of looking at the world based on what your experience is. So that's the personal unconscious. What Graf says is if we look more deeply into ourselves, we find that those learnings from birth on are built upon a deeper foundation. And that foundation is gestation and birth itself. That's when the personality was initially formed, and our life experiences sit on top of that foundation. So here's what he says. Perinatal means around the birth. Perinatal phenomena occur in four distinct experiential patterns, which I call basic perinatal matrices, BPMs, basic perinatal matrices. Each of these four matrices is closely related to one of the four consecutive periods of biological delivery. At each of these stages, the baby undergoes experiences that are characterized by specific emotions and physical feelings. Each of these stages also seems to be associated with specific symbolic images. These come to represent highly individualized psycho-spiritual blueprints, that guide the way we experience our lives. So these are the basic patterns that then the personality is formed from. So presumably, at any moment in your life, not only is there a resonance to similar moments in your childhood, in your past, but there's also a resonance to the birth experience that is similar also to this moment and your childhood moments. Your related childhood moments. So let me say that better. We're influenced not only by what's happening in the here and now, but also by everything that we've learned. And the deepest level of what we learned when we were gestating and being born. That's what he's saying. So, our story thus far. We started, our birth started in the womb, and except for occasional disturbances of intrauterine life, you know, maybe mom ate something that wasn't so good or bumped or something like that, mostly we were in bliss. Mostly we were in heaven. Mostly we were in paradise. Mostly we were in the Garden of Eden. All our needs were satisfied. There was no distinction between me and it. It was all one wonderful thing, oceanic ecstasy. There was no need to be separate from everything. This is the state of unity. But that didn't last. In order to be born, in order to go from one world to another, in order to form an individual sense of self, there had to be birth. And the first, so BPM-1 was the amniotic universe, the paradise which we got booted out of. BPM-2, which we are currently stuck in our story, is when the uterus contracts, but the cervix isn't open yet, and the child feels trapped. No exit situation. Basic hell. The world is collapsing, everything is compressing, and there's no escape from it. It just is ultimate endarkenment. And so I started reading about that last time. I'm going to read a little more about that and then get us out of there. Okay. Everybody with me so far? Understand again, if this is a story, it's a heck of a story. Well, a hell of a story at this point. But it's going to turn out to be a comedy, not a tragedy, folks. Okay. Comedy ends well, tragedy ends poorly, right? This is going to turn out to be a comedy.
Got inside the womb?
Say, yeah, we're inside the womb, but now the contractions are happening, but the cervix hasn't opened yet, so the fetus has nowhere to go. There's an incredible contraction or compression. And this is the substrate of suicidal depression, of really deep depression, when the person can't see out. The person thinks this is going to go on. It's always been like this. It's going to go on forever. There's no escape. And you have to remind a person in that state, if they'll listen to you, that it's an experience you're having. It's part of a process of birth. It's not predictive of what's going to happen the next moment. It's only what it appears at this moment. Kind of hard to get through sometimes, but that's what you got to tell those folks. Okay. A person experiencing a fully developed BPM-2, basic perinatal matrix 2, feels caged, caught in a claustrophobic, nightmarish world. By the way, we talked about this a tiny bit. Where does claustrophobia come from? Why would it be that you would have such an incredibly deep reaction to just being in this kind of enclosed space? It's not really physically threatening you. Why do so many of us freak out? Well, because the resonance goes back to when your life was really threatened, big time. Okay? And so clinically, he puts together so much stuff that a lot of us clinicians have had to take notice of this, because things were not well explained by psychodynamic psychology are better explained by this, and seem, when people work through some of these experiences, to go away in fairly miraculous fashion.
Do we actually know that the fetus feels that?
No, we can't ask the fetus, but he's going to talk about the obstetric understanding. He's going to talk about this a little bit. Okay, but no, there's no way to know that. In fact, he disclaims it. He says, according to current neuropsychological theory, we aren't wired up enough to have memories of this. But many people report memories of this. So are they just making it up, or is there some memory system that we haven't investigated yet that records this? But this is this challenges our current understandings on a bunch of levels. So here we go. A person experiencing a fully developed BPM-2 feels caged, caught in a claustrophobic, nightmarish world. The visual field is dark and ominous, and the general atmosphere is that of unbearable emotional and physical torture. At the same time, the connection with linear time is completely lost, and whatever is happening seems eternal, as if it will never end. Under the influence of BPM-2, one is tuned selectively into the worst and most hopeless aspects of human experience. One's psyche becomes acutely aware of and preoccupied with the darkest, ugliest, and most evil aspects of the universe. BPM-2, I'm excerpting here, so if it isn't entirely smooth, it's because I'm excerpting. BPM2 connects people in an almost mystical sense with the suffering of the world and makes them feel identified with the victimized, downtrodden, and oppressed. People who are especially tuned in to BPM2 tend to see human existence as entirely futile. They may feel that because everything is impermanent, life is in a very fundamental way bereft of any meaning. Any goal-oriented striving is a naive, empty, and ultimately self-deceptive folly. From this perspective, any effort, any ambition or dream for the future is simply doomed to failure. In extreme cases, humans appear to be nothing but pitiful perennial victims who fight a quixotic battle against forces greater than themselves in which they do not have the slightest chance of victory. But you hear, you know, in art, this can be represented. Artists can get really deep. You know, artists get to the essential things. And so you in operas and drama, you know, especially the great stuff, they go to this level. People experience these things or express these things in this way. The experiences of this matrix typically reveal the deep link between the agony of birth and that of death. Seeing the similarity between these two situations usually leads to a sense of profound nihilism and existential crisis. What is this? Just, we're born and we die, we're born and we die. Understand that this is a birth process that the fetus is going through, but it's a death of one sort of existence, of intrauterine existence. So you have to die to be born in this sense. Experiences of BPM2 are best characterized by the triad. And this triad you hear clinically in very depressed people. Or you hear it, no, more than depressed people, you hear it in people that are unwilling to experience certain things, they're unwilling to feel certain feelings, unwilling to allow certain things to come into their consciousness, typically pretty emotionally heavy things that they need to feel in order to get through them. So here's the triad: fear of death, fear of never coming back, and fear of going crazy. So people in very conscious of this matrix feel like they're going to die, they'll never come back, and they're going to go crazy.
I've got a couple of fears. I've got an awful lot of earthquakes, fires, and thunderstorms.
These would be fears related to the birth at the deepest level.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they're true, though. Okay. These are experiences that color our way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
And when one becomes aware of the coloration, one has the opportunity to not be so influenced. That is, if you realize what filter you're looking through, you can realize it's just a filter and you can look to see if there are any other ways of looking. That's what psychodynamic therapy is, right? You realize you have this pattern and at a certain point you try a different pattern. If you've always had difficulty with the opposite sex because you had difficulty with the opposite sex parent and you're always falling into the same issues, then you can realize, oh my God, I'm just playing out mother or dad over and over and over and over again in my life. Why don't I look at it a little differently? Suppose mom or dad and I had a healthier relationship. How would I relate to my spouse now? How would I relate to my kids now? So psychodynamic therapy is all about seeing the tunnel vision you have, realizing where it comes from, and then looking differently and trying out a different pattern. That's called working through in psychodynamic therapy. This is a deeper level of realizing what the blinders are and seeing what the possibilities would be to see the world from a different basic perinatal matrix, different point of view. Let's keep going, yeah? Okay. Because we don't want to stand. We want to get out of here. Okay. Characteristically, the loss of any linear time that is associated with this matrix can lead to the conviction that this unbearable moment will last forever. But even in a very long labor, it doesn't. like the first basic perinatal matrix, the paradisical one, BPM2 has a rich spiritual and mythological dimension. Archetypal images expressing the quality of experiences belonging to this category are found throughout the cultures of the world. The motif of unbearable emotional and physical suffering that will never end finds its fullest expression in the images of hell and the underworld found in most cultures. Damned forever. In Christian literature, BPM2 is echoed in the dark night of the soul, envisioned by mystics such as St. John of the Cross, who saw it as an important stage in one's spiritual development. Jung said, people are never going to go here. The process, the journey to full, you know, full consciousness is one that is perilous, fraught with peril, and people are defended against it mightily, and they won't go there. But if you want to really understand at the deepest level who you are and what this is and be freed of those blinders, you have to go through this process, this perilous journey that Dante went through with an angel by his side. And I think all of us go through this at whatever level we're karmically fated to go through it, whatever level we're able to go through it. I think this resonates with everybody, and I think everybody's journey touches these areas, but I think very few of us have to walk through these areas in their full fury. Thank God. So St. John of the Cross said the dark night of the soul, which is an important stage in one's spiritual development. Particularly relevant is the story of Adam and Eve in their expulsion from paradise and the origin of primal sin. Question is, what is this original sin stuff? Why did we get thrown out of paradise? You know, what is it about being in a body and separate from other people that causes this distress? In Genesis, God links this situation specifically to birth and labor pains when he announces to Eve, "In pain and sorrow shalt thou bring forth children." The loss of the celestial realm is described in the story of the fall of the angels that leads to the creation of the polarity between heaven and hell. Christian descriptions of hell show specific connections to the experiences of BPM2. Now, the profundity of Graf's work, if you're a mythologist or an artist working on the archetypal levels, is I'm skipping all that, but you should read what he said about all the symbology from all the world's cultures and how it ties so neatly into this understanding, where these archetypal images come from. People often make references to Dante's Inferno as a dramatic description of BPM2. They see the entire Divine Comedy as an account of the transformational journey and of spiritual opening. And remember, that one has to do with, you want to get Beatrice, you want to get up to heaven, the way up is down. That, the other way that Stan says this all the time is, you know, you can't, the only way out of this is through. You can't back away from it. If it's something that's necessary for you to experience, you have to surrender to the experience and let it happen without identifying with it, or else it chews you up completely. Well, it does chew you up completely anyway. All right. Like BPM1, this matrix links up with memories from later life whose qualities are similar to the experiences encountered here. When we experience such traumatic events in our lives, the event in the present carries us back to the corresponding perinatal material, reactivating our old emotional and physical pain. We're then responding not only to the present situation, but also to an early fundamental trauma. This can explain the depth of the psychological damage and lasting negative effects following wars, natural catastrophes, time in concentration camps, or kidnapping by terrorists. These situations are not only traumatic in themselves, which is serious enough, but they also strip the victims of defenses that ordinarily protect them from the painful elements of the unconscious material they're harboring in their psyches. To work effectively with these states, one has to create a supportive environment, and use techniques that allow these people to relive and work through not only the relatively recent adult traumas, but also the underlying primary memories of victimization associated with BPM2. BPM2 is the ultimate victim. No escape from victimization. So he just talked about major traumas carrying you back to the birth trauma. Now he's talking a little more subtly. On the subtler level, the second matrix can also involve memories of severe psychological frustrations, because, again, this is the ultimate frustration. You can't get out of the womb. So any experience of frustration will bring this hopelessness with it.
I have a problem.
The way you look at it, the hopelessness that you feel, it's a feeling you have. It's not actually true. There is hope. You just can't see it.
I think he had trouble getting me out.
Many of us have a substantial dose of hopelessness in us because we had a substantial dose of hopelessness early on.
Well, I think he had a hard time getting me out. That's what my mom said.
Yeah, and so that would explain some of the feelings that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, all right, so on a subtler level, the second matrix can also involve memories of severe psychological frustrations, particularly abandonment, rejection, deprivation, emotionally threatening events, and confining or oppressive situations in the nuclear family and later life. So, all right. Abandonment. Suddenly mom who is all your needs, suddenly you're alone in hell. Okay. Rejection. Get out of the womb. Deprivation. It's all gone. Emotionally threatening events. It's all closing in on me. And confining or oppressive situations in the nuclear family and later in life. Thus, being in the role of victim in the family of origin, in the classroom, in intimate relationships, in the workplace, and in society at large will reinforce and perpetuate the memory of the no-exit stage of birth. So when you're in the classroom and you fail again, you walk into the classroom hopeless. I have students that walk into the classroom absolutely convinced that they're going to knock it out of their life. Because they've given up hope that they could succeed in that situation because they've been victimized in the classroom. Probably they've been victimized in their early childhood, and maybe they were victimized in their birth. Okay. Or they were certainly victimized at some level at their birth. And the childhood and classroom events reinforce that deep feeling of no escape from this. All right, enough. We got to get out of this place. Okay? If it's the last thing we ever do.
That's hopeless.
We got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you, right? That's what he's talking about. Okay, from hell, the passage. Come on, let's get out of here. The passage from hell to purgatory. If nothing else, it's a hell of a
story.
It's an interesting story. It's not a hell of a story anymore. It's an interesting story. Each uterine contraction in this stage of the birth process, okay? Each uterine contraction in this stage of the birth process pulls the cervix over the head of the infant and dilates the cervical opening. When the cervix is finally open and the head descends into the pelvis, there is a great change not only in the biological, but also in the psychological experience of the delivery. The no-exit situation of BPM2 changes into a slow passage through the birth canal, characterizing BPM3. This is louder than I usually talk, but I'm trying to broadcast for everybody. Just don't want to use that. So can everybody hear back there okay?
Yeah.
They used to yell at me for having too loud a voice.
No, it wasn't okay.
But thank you. Everything has a meaning at some point in your life. Everything has a meaning. All right. The death rebirth struggle. BPM 3. While there are certain parallels between this matrix, BPM 3, and the previous one, there are significant differences that should be carefully noted. In the previous matrix, the cervix was closed. Now it is open, allowing the fetus to move through the birth canal. Although the fight for survival continues, there is now a sense of hope, a belief that there will be an end to the struggle. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. Just hope it ain't no train.
The train comes when I take the Amtrak to L.A. He's going to be doing a chat for it.
All right. At this stage, the infant's head is wedged into the pelvic opening, which is so narrow that even under normal circumstances, the passage is slow and tedious. The musculature of the uterus is very strong, and the power of its contractions, the contractions of the uterus, oscillates between 50 and 100 pounds. This creates an atmosphere of conflicting and clashing energies and a strong hydraulic pressure. The organism of the mother and that of the child are still very intimately connected on many levels. For that reason, there may be a strong identification between the two. In the memory record of this matrix, we have no sense of a boundary between ourselves and our mother. Neither the physical nor the psychological separation has occurred. Mother and child are still one consciousness. Thus, it's possible to experience all the feelings and sensations of the infant, to fully identify with the delivering mother, and to connect with the archetype of the delivering woman. So at this stage, people re-experiencing this in non-ordinary states of consciousness feel they're at one point the infant being delivered, the mother doing the delivery, and the archetype of birth. In addition to experiencing intense physical pains, anxiety, aggression, a strange sense of excitement, and a driving energy, this matrix is characterized by sexual arousal. In addition to experiencing intense physical pains, anxiety, aggression, a strange sense of excitement, and a driving energy, this matrix is characterized by sexual arousal. So Freud was wrong. There isn't, infantile sexuality isn't the be-all and end-all of it. Remember when he said that, people said, oh my God, you're telling me 2 or 3 year olds can have sexual feelings? What a bad guy you are, Freud. Turns out it's deeper than that. Sexuality goes back to the process of birth itself.
But the Republicans think so. The penis and the heart.
I'm sure some cartoonist is making a picture of the United States as being trapped in the birth canal now, because the delivery has been blocked. You know, Stan has tons of cartoons from all around the world which show these perinatal matrices really in graphic form. They're typically about things that happen to the whole society. You know, but he's got thousands of them at this point that show that the artists kind of tune into the essence of things, especially cartoonists, because they only have one frame. Right? This connection, combined with other events, connection of all these things, this connection combined with other events forms a natural basis for the development of a variety of sexual disorders and deviations later in life. Stan has mapped a lot of mysterious sexual deviations to aspects of the birth process. Perhaps the most striking aspect of this matrix is the atmosphere of titanic struggle, frequently of catastrophic proportions. It clearly reflects the enormous conflicting energies involved in this stage of the birth process that we're seeking to discharge. So there's an enormous amount of energy built up here that needs discharge. So it's a titanic struggle to be born. And the catastrophic proportion of it is what happens in this birth process is a death at the same, it's the death of the existence in the womb in the process of being born outside the womb. Okay, so there's also a form of inward directed aggression associated with this matrix that has a self-destructive quality. This aggression, expressed in self-destructive fantasies and impulses, seems to be the internalization of forces that were originally imposed on us from the outside, the uterine contractions and the resistance within the birth canal. The memory of this experience survives in us as a sense of emotional and physical confinement and the inability to enjoy our lives fully. It sometimes takes the form of a cruel inner judge demanding punishment, a savage part of the superego that can drive the person to extremes of self-destructiveness. This is the beginning of self-hatred, or at least of severe self-criticism. You know, Freud said that depression was anger turned inward, remember? And so he's saying that some of that may have to do with the great inward directed aggression, because there's nowhere outside to put it. Things are pressing in on you, but you want to push out, and if you can't do that, you tend to internalize those feelings. So far what we've said is in the third basic perinatal matrix, there's intense pressure moving, and both mother and child are working together to move you through the birth canal. But things are very, it's a very difficult passage. All right. As the intensity of experiences associated with this matrix increase, should be increases.
Yeah.
Ah! Where's that editor? Okay. As the intensity of experiences associated with this matrix increases, the emotions and sensations that were originally polar opposites, pain versus pleasure, for example, begin to converge. Emotions and sensations that were originally polar opposites begin to converge. They may eventually merge into a single undifferentiated state of mind containing all possible dimensions of human experience. Intense suffering and exquisite pleasure become the same. Caustic heat feels like freezing cold. Murderous aggression and passionate love become one. And the agony of death becomes the ecstasy of birth. When the suffering reaches its absolute apex, the situation oddly ceases to have the quality of suffering and agony. Instead, the very intensity of the experience is transformed into wild, ecstatic rapture that can be described as Dionysian or volcanic ecstasy. The suffering becomes so great that it opens into an experience of rapture or of ecstasy. This volcanic ecstasy or rapture can go even further until it reaches transcendental proportions. In contrast to the oceanic ecstasy associated with BPM-1, this volcanic type involves enormous explosive tension with both aggressive and self-destructive elements. This form of rapture can be experienced in childbirth, in accidents, or in rituals using physically painful procedures, such as the practice of the flagellants or the Native American sun dance, in which the person voluntarily undergoes intense physical pain for a prolonged period of time. A certain level of volcanic ecstasy can be reached in Aboriginal ceremonies that involve wild dancing and loud, intoxicating music, or even in their modern counterparts, certain rock concerts. You know how when sometimes when people who have been under a great deal of pressure, when they lose control and they just become, go berserk, they go into a kind of crazy rapture, in that the release is so necessary for them that they lose the oppression that was in them, then becomes the oppression that comes out of them. Let's keep going, because I want to get us out of here. What is perhaps most, and this is a strange matrix, because he's putting together so many things that you wouldn't think would go together. What is perhaps most curious about BPM-3 is the emotional proximity of death and sexuality. One would think that the threat of death would erase any libidinal feelings. However, where this matrix is concerned, the opposite seems to be true. Observations from clinical psychiatry, experiences of people who have been tortured in concentration and prison camps, and the files of Amnesty International attest to the fact that there are strong interrelationships between the ecstatic rapture of sex, childbirth, and the extreme threat to bodily integrity and survival. In the death-rebirth process, motifs related to all three of these areas alternate or even coexist in various combinations. So the triad that is ambient here is birth, sex, and death. And they seem to be intimately related on the very deepest psychological level. You know, the French call orgasm le petit mort, the little death, right? People have, in orgasm, people have experiences of death and rebirth sometimes. The mythological and spiritual aspects of this matrix are particularly rich and variegated. The titanic aspect can be expressed in the archetypal images of confrontation between the forces of good and evil, or of the destruction and creation of the world. Okay, so I'm not reading well. The titanic aspect can be expressed in the archetypal images of confrontation between the forces of good and evil, or the destruction and creation of the world. Another form of the struggle to find balance between good and evil is the archetype of the divine judgment. The aggressive sequences are often associated with images of destructive deities, such as Kali, Shiva, Satan, or Mars. Coactical? Not Quetzalcoatl. This is a different one. C-O-A-T, coat, L-I-C-U-E. I don't know. Anyway, that's the Mayan one, I would guess. Or Mars. Particularly characteristic is a close identification with mythological figures representing death and rebirth that can be found in every major culture. Osiris, Dionysius, Persephone, Wotan, Baldur, and many others. Our own culture's variety of this theme is the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Frequently, people facing BPM-3 have visions of crucifixion, where they feel fully identified with Jesus on the cross. Scenes of sacrifice and self-sacrifice accompanied by the corresponding deities, particularly Aztec and Mayan, also abound in this stage. And you see this in the art of people, the artists that go to this level. You see these archetypal images coming up. The transition between BPM 3 and 4 is often associated with visions of consuming fires. These flames destroy everything that is corrupt or rotten in our lives, preparing us for rebirth and renewal. It is interesting that in the corresponding stage of delivery, many mothers feel that their entire genital areas are on fire. Reliving this stage in a passive role, people might feel that their bodies are burning, or that they are passing through flames or purification. This is particularly well expressed in the phoenix myth, the fabulous bird of Egyptian legend, who at the age of 500 years burns itself on a pyre. Then from its ashes, another phoenix arises. The purifying fire is also characteristic for the religious imagery of purgatory. This is the purgatorial purification stage in our mythology. So the passage through fire is a characteristic of the last stage of the delivery. When you're moving from BPM 3 to the extrauterine experience. The combination of high drama, sex, and violence, characteristic of this matrix, is the magic formula for much of modern filmmaking. Almost done with this matrix. The third matrix represents an enormous pool of problematic emotions and difficult sensations that can, in combination with later events in infancy and childhood, contribute to the development of a variety of disorders. Amongst them are certain forms of depression and conditions that involve aggression and violent self-destruction. Also, obsessive-compulsive neuroses, phobias, and hysterical manifestations seem to have important roots in this matrix. Which of the many possible forms of emotional disorders would actually manifest seems to be co-determined by the nature of later biographical experiences that can selectively reinforce the aggressive, self-destructive, sexual, or scatological aspects of BPM 3. Okay. So I got to say, those of you who have sat through this, this is not easy to listen to, and sparks in some people some very kind of deep, difficult feelings. I hope if that happens that you talk to me right after class and say, you know, what do I do with these feelings? The reason that we pass through this is where we're going is to something really wonderful that presumably is opened up to us more fully for having at least listened to the passage. So the experiences that we're about to realize come from having entertained at whatever level we're able to this movement. That's why I did this, not because I wanted to torture you, but because I wanted to give you a gift that couldn't be given in an emotional level without having participated in at least one level of this birth, death, and rebirth process. Understand? This is the rationale. But this is, I think for some people, this wasn't the sweetness and light that they thought they were going to get into, but it's worth it. Okay. Abraham and then Michael, and then I've got to at least start us on BPM 4. Okay, Abraham.
Did he talk about cesarean birth?
Yeah, later he says, I'm going to read it again later. He says that cesareans, it's a different pattern. They don't have as much BPM 3. There isn't as much struggle, but there's not as much accomplishment. Okay. Michael.
Before you talked about BPM 3 being the time where the infant engaged in the birth process.
Yeah.
And I didn't get...
Okay, so I might have not... Okay, so in BPM 2, you're a victim. Everything is coming in on you. There's no hope. It's never going to end completely dark. In BPM 3, there's a tunnel. This is the idea of the tunnel. This is the tunnel that when you die, you go through the tunnel. Okay, it's also the birth tunnel. And you're struggling to be born, and your mom, it's all unity. Your mom and you are struggling to birth you. So there's in this matrix the feeling of trying really hard to achieve something, and then because of your efforts, achieving it. This is the prototype of accomplishment. So if you don't have this matrix, either you're people for whom this wasn't successful and they had to be pulled out with forceps, for example, they sometimes have the feeling that whatever I do, I'm going to fail at it. And I have to be rescued. Because you were pulled out rather than coming out naturally. There's all kind of parallels to this. But the essential thing about BPM 3 is there's a struggle in which you are an active participant. If life is lousy, you can do stuff hard as it is to make your life better. This is the prototype of going from a hellish existence or an unsatisfactory existence to a more satisfactory existence. It involves a lot of work and a lot of struggle and a lot of difficulty, but the potential is to be reborn in a better way, to make a life that is better than the life you're leaving. Otherwise, why would the people have come across the country in covered wagons, you know? Because they were leaving something that was not viable, and they were willing to go through a passage to get to a promised land.
Moses.
Yeah.
You got to get out, and you got to go through the birth canal, which is the Red Sea, which parts magically for you. And then, you know, the point is that image of the waters like this, that's the birth canal. That's BPM 3. That's going from the hell of Egypt, where you're getting killed, you know, through the birth canal to the land of milk and honey, to the promised land. I mean, this is... All right, so let me just set up BPM 4, because that's where we're going to go.
Yeah. Really quick. Can you have reached BPM 3 and still have characteristics of BPM 2?
All these things are in you. At various points when your life feels like it's overwhelming, you feel like all is lost. Yeah, each of these... Sometimes, you know, when you go to bed at night and you just melt into your bed and you kind of, that's BPM 1. All these things are the substrates of our personality. The idea is to not get lost in these things and realize that these things kind of coexist and to spend most of one's time where we're going. Okay? These are experiences that you never lose in your personality, but instead of going from being an infant and everybody and your parents take care of you, then you get kicked out of being an infant, so you have to start the birth process to being an adult, right? And the idea is to not spend the rest of your life as a victim, or not spend the rest of your life struggling against impossible odds, but eventually to come to where we're going. All right. The struggle ends. And this, I'll just set it up now. The struggle ends. As the agonizing struggle to escape from the birth canal nears the end, tension and suffering reach an apex. This is followed by an explosive release as the infant suddenly breaks free from the pelvic opening and takes its first breath. I'm going to wait till the distraction happens because this is important. Okay, I'll go. As the agonizing struggle to escape from the birth canal nears the end, tension and suffering reach an apex. This is followed by an explosive release as the infant suddenly breaks free from the pelvic opening and takes its first breath. In general, this moment holds the promise of tremendous relaxation, but the degree to which this actually happens depends upon the specific circumstances surrounding the birth, such as the opportunity for loving contact with the mother, bonding through eye contact, and other factors. The death-rebirth experience, BPM 4.
What's it called?
BPM 4.
It's called what?
Basic perinatal matrix. Oh, what's it called? It's called the death and rebirth experience itself. All right, so what can I say to prime you for this? This is going to be a long birth here because we got 2 weeks worth of, I guess we got 2 weeks worth of getting prepared here before we get delivered. Okay, but the message from last week is sometimes you feel like nothing you can do will make any difference. Sometimes you feel hopeless in life. That's part of being alive. The message for this week is that experience doesn't persist. At some point, that experience gives way, or you see your way clear to realizing that there is some hope here. I just have to go get it. I have to make it happen. So the third basic perinatal matrix gives you the strength to do what you need to do to make a life that you want. It's the ambient determination and courage in you that gets you through difficulty to some outcome that you wish to have happen. So you've got a passivity, and you've also got an activity in you. You've got and the activity should supplant the passivity. From being a victim, you go to being an achiever. somebody who is determined to make the, to make a better situation. And if you tap into the BPM3 energies, you could surmount anything. So that's the lesson so far, where you're going to get to, the kind of person that you can become as you evolve fully through this process on an adult level, as you go through a rebirth that we're going through, that's where we're going. So there's a light at the end of the tunnel here, okay? Okay, so